Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the Woj Pod. Get the inside scoop on all the biggest NBA news as the biggest names in the game join ESPN's Adrian Wojnarowski for the Woj Pod, featuring in-depth conversations, breaking news reaction and analysis, and coverage of the biggest events on the NBA calendar, as well as an occasional deep dive into some of the most notable events in NBA history. On the latest episode, ESPN's Jay Billis discusses the changing face of feeder systems to the NBA, the 2021 draft, the college versus NBA coaching worlds, Quinn Snyder, and the GM job he turned down 13 years ago. Follow the Woj Pod as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcast. Also, ESPN Films' latest documentary, 144, executive produced by ESPN Radio and First Take Her Take podcast host, as well as current WNBA player Chinne Agumike, takes viewers inside the WNBA's unexpected 2020 season. 4 months after the WNBA postponed its season due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the league set out to play a condensed season entirely in a bubble, where 144 players across 12 teams not only came together to play basketball, but also to dedicate their season to social justice. 144 will premiere May 13th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on ESPN. The film will be available on ESPN Plus immediately after its premiere. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, Kyle Shanahan showing us that he's not a moron. Also, your stories about encounters with the repo man. But first... Oh, man, we were all sitting around getting ready for the draft, trying to figure out what it was that the 49ers were ultimately going to do. Why are we going to get to that second? Because before we could even get to what the 49ers were going to do, it was bombshell time. Aaron Rodgers wants out of Green Bay. Peace out. He has had enough of this. So we had draft night going where we thought there was a possibility he might get traded. We got a lot of reports out of Denver that a deal was close to send him over there. All of that. And right now, Aaron Rodgers still plays for the Green Bay Packers. Seems to be a little bit salty. Did you see that thing? I saw a tweet about this game where he went to the Kentucky Derby. And the good folks at NBC said that Aaron Rodgers declined to do an interview with NBC, but he told Mike Tirico that he was disappointed that this news had gotten out. And I'm like, I thought he declined to talk to NBC. I'm a little lost. Like, NBC's like, he won't talk to us, but this is what he told us. But okay, right? He said that he was disappointed that the news got out. And my read on that is, like, are you disappointed with your agent? Are you disappointed with your publicist? Because it seems to me to be very difficult to believe that the Packers were the ones who decided to put this out. That's just that I don't understand what it was that they would get out of it. And to be fair to Aaron Rodgers, it is possible he is disappointed with his own people. They may have decided to make an executive decision in order to try to make this happen. But Aaron Rodgers does not want to play for the Packers anymore. And I have to say, I find it hysterical that the people in my industry have pretended as though he has any leverage in this situation whatsoever. He has none, right? Well, no, that's not fair. He has some leverage, but all his leverage comes from doing extreme things. Either he doesn't show up at all, he's willing to go home and retire and pay back 20-something million dollars for not coming to play, or he gonna show up and act a donkey. Those are the only two ways, the way that I see it, that he has any leverage to get out of there. Otherwise, why? Aaron says he doesn't want to be here anymore and we don't want him to be sad, so we're going to go ahead and trade him. And look, I understand that we have raised a generation of youngsters who believe dumb shit like that, right? Like, they think that just because you're a little bit unhappy, somebody's going to do something in order to make you happy. That's generally and typically not the way that these things work. I can only think of one legitimate example that is similar to this one, right? And that is 10 years ago when Carson Palmer decided he didn't want to play for the Bengals anymore. He said he wasn't going to do it. And the Bengals said, all right, well, go ahead, take it to the crib then. And he said, fine. And he went and took it to the crib. He put a for sale sign in front of his house. In the 2011 draft, the Bengals went ahead and drafted Andy Dalton in the second round. And he started from day one on. That Bengals team did ultimately make the playoffs. Now, did Palmer wind up getting out of there? Yes, he got traded. But what it took for him to get traded, you may not remember this, but I do. It was a very interesting situation. Hugh Jackson was coaching the Raiders. Now, it's important to note that Hugh Jackson also used to work with the Bengals, and he looked at Carson Palmer as what a quarterback should look like. Like, he saw Carson Palmer as the prototype of what an NFL quarterback should be. And 10 years ago, I see his point, right? Like, I see why you would say that. He looked exactly what a quarterback looked like for all that time back in the day. So he's coaching the Raiders. The Raiders are actually good. Like, every time somebody talks about Hugh Jackson not being able to coach, the Raiders were good that year. Jason Campbell was the quarterback. Then Campbell got hurt and Al Davis died. I don't remember which happened first, whether Al Davis died or Campbell got hurt. I think that Al died and then Campbell got hurt. A power vacuum then developed and Hugh Jackson wound up being the dude that was in charge. And so he traded a first round pick and a little more in order to get Carson Palmer, and they brought Palmer in. But again, I want you to think about this for a second. They sent Carson Palmer to the Raiders. Like, I understand that they were good that year, but they were still the Raiders and in a long stretch of mediocrity. But what it took was a team owner dying, a coach who used to work with him, having a job in that place and being in a position to make an executive decision, and somebody getting hurt. Those are all the things that it took in order for that trade to happen. Then it took Palmer eventually winding up in Arizona before he got things back on track. But the Bengals didn't have to trade him. And so they did not trade him until it was worth it for them ultimately to trade him, right? Me and Dominique talk about this all the time with quarterbacks. Well, he talks about it more than I do, but he's got that point that all these quarterbacks think they somehow different until they wind up in an actual conflict with their bosses. And then they realize, oh no, they'll do you the exact same way. Think to yourself, how many quarterbacks have legitimately left somewhere on their own terms? Like, you might wind up in a place as that quarterback where your terms kind of overlap with the team's. Case in point, Matt Stafford and what happened in Detroit, where he was like, yeah, guys, I kind of want to be traded. And they were like, are you sure? Whew. Yeah, great, we can do that. You know, but overall, I've gone through this in time. The only two quarterbacks that I can think of and that I've seen that really got to leave on their own terms, John Elway and Roger Staubach. Those are the only two. And by the way, by the time Staubach left, like, time was up. He didn't really have anything left. Elway probably didn't have much left, but he still got to leave on his own terms. Now, in the end, man, you know what these quarterbacks are? Football players. In the end, the owners don't have any more respect for the quarterbacks than they have for anybody else. Now, with the Packers, what gets interesting is the Packers don't really have an owner. They got a CEO, a dude named Mark Murphy, but they're a publicly owned team. There is no, like, specific owner that you were dealing with. And so Andrew Brandt, who used to work with the Packers, I think he worked with the Packers when the Brett Favre situation was going down 13 years ago. Greg Bedard made this point that Mark Murphy is the common thread between these situations, the CEO guy. Here's the thing, and where I don't think that the Packers have really gotten enough credit. In both of these cases, they have had the courage to do what most teams do not, which is actively start moving on from your Hall of Fame quarterback before he gets sorry. That doesn't really happen very much, in large part because people are so worried about the feelings of the quarterback, or they just cross their fingers and hold on and hope that dude can stay good. Look at what's happening in Atlanta right now. To me, it is ridiculous that in a draft that had quarterbacks, where the Falcons had the number 4 pick, that they did not go get a quarterback. It doesn't matter if you think that Matt Ryan can play right now. He's 35 years old. How long do you think that this is going to go, right? You go ahead and start working on your plan and then go from there. it would probably be best for you to talk to whoever your quarterback is once you do that. Right? Look, Matt, here's the deal. We're going to draft a quarterback this year. If he's ready to start next year, we're going to make him the starter. If he's not ready to start next year and you're killing it, then we'll probably stay with you for another year. But we got to start looking at what the future is going to be, and we're going to bring somebody else in to be that future. At every other position, teams are willing to do this. Now, the difference, of course, between quarterback and every other position is that there can only be one. But the big reason with quarterbacks that there can only be one is because there are fewer of them. You know? So, like, you could go get your next great middle linebacker, for example, if you wanted to, because you can find something else to do with that guy while he's around there or whatever it is. There can really only be one quarterback. So when you go take a quarterback and you already got a quarterback, you're absolutely putting that dude on notice. The time is about to be up, right? That's the game. And so where the Packers messed up with Aaron Rodgers was they decided to take this guy without, like Jordan Love, without really having a plan. And people will make the point that what the Packers did in drafting Jordan Love is the same thing that they did when they drafted Aaron Rodgers in the presence of Brett Favre. I would disagree. Here's why I would disagree. Because one of them is Jordan Love, and the other one is Aaron Rodgers, okay? Now, yeah, they got Aaron Rodgers with the 24th pick in the draft or the 25th. I can't remember which one. That detail doesn't really matter that much. But we were going into that draft thinking that Aaron Rodgers could slash would be the number one pick in the draft. And he fell all the way down to the Packers, and they looked around and were like, yo, we got to do this. And by the way, turned out to be a great decision. When Jordan Love was still sitting there for the Packers to take him, everybody thought that Jordan Love would still be there for the Packers to take him. It did not feel like they just stumbled into unexpected treasure. You know what I mean? That wasn't how it felt with the Jordan Love situation. It really felt like, dog, why are you doing this?
Yeah, are you willing to risk it all for Jordan Love?
But I understood why they did it, and this is why I say they get some measure of credit, even though I see there's a difference between this and the situation in 2005. Rodgers was falling off, right? Like, you can go look at a lot of those raw counting stats, and you can still talk about all the touchdowns and all the yards he threw and the few interceptions, and Rodgers and his interception count is always an interesting thing because it speaks to something good as much as it speaks to something bad, and that bad is his level of risk aversion. It looked like he was sliding. He's sliding. He's in his mid-30s, and a significant part of his game is predicated on athleticism. And so if you look at a guy like that and feel like he's getting less athletic, then you do need to start looking for your next quarterback. But once you take that guy, especially under this new state of affairs with the rookie wage scale and everything else, you take that guy this year, you were telling us he's going to be our quarterback next year. You can go look through it, all right? I think Paxton Lynch is the only exception here. Every quarterback that's been taken in the first round since the rookie wage scale was instituted has become the starter by year two. They may not have stayed the starter, but they became the starter by year two. So when they took Jordan Love, that is a signal he's going to be our quarterback in 2021. Or it should have been your signal that he was going to be your quarterback in 2021. Here's the problem. Aaron Rodgers won the MVP. That was the problem. The old man kicked it back into gear. Now, we have a problem. What exactly is it that we are supposed to do because Aaron Rodgers is still good? And their answer was, duh, keep Aaron Rodgers. That's what they decided it was that they were going to do. But they needed to do a lot more to make him feel good about what the situation was, because y'all really did say, you're done in this town. That's what you say when you take a quarterback in the first round. You're done in this town. And now they're like, okay, cool. Well, how now? We'd like to keep you for a few more years. And Aaron Rodgers is like, nah, I'm good. I don't really want to be kept for a few more years. And they're like, yeah, we got this thing called a contract. We got you. You kind of belong to us. You kind of can't leave until we say that you can leave.
So I get why he's mad, but I don't know what he's supposed to do about it. It's the same thing I said about Deshaun Watson. But Deshaun Watson was like, yeah, you know, I ain't going, you know, well, you know, back when things were different, you know, like, oh man, I don't want to go play for them no more. People in hell want ice water, baby. So what? You know, like, this isn't going to be your thing. And so that's where, to me, watching this Aaron Rodgers thing play out is going to be interesting, because his really only path out of there is acting indignant. Like, that's what he's going to have to do, is act indignant. We talked about the possibility of Deshaun Watson fetching 3 first-round picks, right? Deshaun Watson's a lot younger than Aaron Rodgers is. And in spite of the fact that Aaron Rodgers played well last year, none of us know how many years Aaron Rodgers has left in him. Are you giving up 3 first-round picks to go get him? I probably would not. Denver, maybe. Different situation. Because you notice, they're a team that could use a quarterback, and a team that would definitely jump on Aaron Rodgers, I think, if it really became available. And we've heard all the word that they were trying. But they didn't draft a quarterback, which they absolutely had the option to do. They could have gotten Justin Fields. They could have gotten Mac Jones. And again, as I say, Justin Fields, I didn't think there was any way that John Elway would let Justin Fields go past him. My guess is they think they can get Aaron Rodgers. They think that that's a realistic possibility, that they can go draft Aaron Rodgers. Maybe they can. I don't know. But he just going to be down in the dumps, man. He just going to wind up being sad. There's no real easy resolution to it for him. The person I feel bad for in this, honestly, is Jordan Love. Unless he's like for real ready to play next year, unless he is a lot better than I think he is going to be, he ain't got no chance. None. Like, if Aaron Rodgers were to retire and then Jordan Love became the quarterback, and then he, you know, played okay and looked solid, people could let that ride. But if it looks like you push the MVP out in order to get solid out there for a team that has never had a black starting quarterback, they've had black guys start games, but they haven't had a black starting quarterback. Man, that ain't going to be no easy game for him. That is not going to be an easy role for him. And it's all because the Packers handled this wrong. And the truth was, even with Aaron Rodgers winning MVP, they needed to say to themselves, this is Aaron's last year, and we're going to go get another guy. And trading him, like, I don't know if you saw this, Gabe, but the 49ers, they apparently offered the number 3 pick and a little more to try to get Rodgers. But the problem was, the number 3 pick wasn't valuable to them because they have a quarterback. Like, the real value of that pick was going to be if you need a quarterback. Well, the Packers believe they already have a quarterback. So the number 3 pick, that wasn't going to do it for them. I don't know what the package is that would ultimately make it worth it for him. But the other problem for Aaron Rodgers is they can't trade him to somebody good, because that's embarrassing. If he went to San Francisco, they'd win the Super Bowl. I think most of us believe that. They'd win the Super Bowl. They can't have that. And last thing I tell you, I think I saw Rob Domofsky, who covers the Packers for ESPN. He made a great point that when it was time to trade Brett Favre, they asked him, they said, look, we got the Bucks and we got the Jets. Where you want to go? And he said, I want to go to the Bucks. They traded him to the Jets. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This one could get a lot uglier. And it all depends on how ugly Aaron Rodgers wants it to get. But if it don't get ugly, he ain't going nowhere. Man, he better figure that out quick. I see you, Kyle Shanahan. I see you. You got us, and you didn't even try to get us. But you got us. All right. Okay, the 49ers, that's your squad, right?
That's my squad.
How are you feeling about the prospect of the Mac Jones era?
How was I feeling?
Yes.
Just another knife in the heart to my fandom, I thought.
That's right, because you're too young to remember the glory days.
One of my earliest memories of being a 49ers fan was when Steve Young, his last game, basically.
Yeah.
Against the Cardinals when he got concussed. And that was like, oh, that's a wrap for Steve Young.
Yeah. Like, you do not remember the best of the 49ers. So for you, you just thirsty for a Super Bowl. Because when I was a kid, they won every year. Like, it really felt like they won every single year. Like, when I was a kid, for example, the Packers. I kept hearing about the Packers. But I had no idea what you were talking about, because they were sorry. Like, they got better when I was around like 10 years old. It was like the Yankees were that way for me. I was like, y'all keep talking about the Yankees. The Yankees, sorry, right? And then, like, eventually they came back around. And so the 49ers in a similar place. And so, as you guys know, this year, they traded the farm in order to move up to the number three pick in the draft, which I found to be a very interesting move. And then Chris Sims popped up, okay? Chris Sims and Kyle Shanahan played together at Texas. And Sims made the point that the 49ers believe they have a team that can win a Super Bowl this year. You don't move up to the number three pick in the draft unless you think you're getting a guy who's ready to play right away. And Chris Sims said the guy who would be ready to play right away was Mac Jones. Now, it's important to note, Sims didn't say that Shanahan thought that Mac Jones was the guy who was ready to play right away, but he said Mac Jones was the guy who was ready to play right away. So we add Sims having a level of expertise to the fact that he has Kyle Shanahan's initials tattooed on his body. Tony over there didn't know that. Yes. All right. He did not know that. And so we assumed Chris Sims must know something. And then suddenly, Mac Jones, number three pick in the draft. And then after that, everybody got on TV and start rationalizing the idea that Mac Jones would be the number three pick in the draft. Like, I want to send a shout out to my homie Marcus Spears, right? Love Spears. We keep trying to get him on the podcast, but his schedule doesn't work for it. But Spears got on TV for anybody who would listen. Ain't nobody taking Mac Jones with the number three pick in the draft. He said it over and over again. And you know why? Because nobody trades three first round picks to take Mac Jones, which an obvious point, something that is very, very clear. None of us thought that Mac Jones was of the caliber of player to move up to the third pick in the draft to take him, let alone that you just take him with the third pick in the draft, right? Marcus stood on that table. I found a lot of my other colleagues, I'm gonna let y'all live without y'all's names being out there, and they got caught in a dilemma. And their dilemma was they believe Kyle Shanahan was a genius. And so rather than saying, if the genius takes Mac Jones with the number three pick in the draft, he's actually not a genius, what people had to then do was rationalize why it is that Kyle Shanahan would take Mac Jones with the number three pick in the draft. And what I kept hearing was he was the best passing fit for Kyle Shanahan's system. He was the best passing fit for Kyle Shanahan's system. But nobody ever explained to me why he was the best passing fit for Kyle Shanahan's system. Not one person ever told me something particular to Mac Jones that did not apply to these other guys that made him such a perfect fit. Now, when I saw people talk about why they liked Mac Jones, they talked about how well he processed information and they talked about the accuracy. Gabe, you watch the 49ers. How much accuracy you need to throw to somebody butt-naked open?
Well, I mean, all the 49ers writers were talking about pocket, being able to throw from the pocket, and somehow Mac Jones was the best at throwing from the pocket.
Yeah. But even then, that's broad. And when did Justin Fields not be able to throw from the pocket? Lamar Jackson, for example, was a guy who spent his college years passing from the pocket. If you went back and watched it, that was what he did. Right? When people make the point about a guy being able to pass from the pocket, what they're really saying is they can't pass from outside the pocket. Therefore, that means they can pass from inside the pocket. And what they're really saying is, even if they don't realize it, is that this dude is white. Like in the end, that's what they were saying. This dude is white. Trey Lance played in a system that was very pro-oriented, that involved passing from the pocket. Now, he didn't have nearly as many reps as Mac Jones did, obviously, right? But it isn't really that many. Like, Mac Jones played like half of last year and this year, you know, as a starter, but it wasn't like he was some four-year starter or something like that. But people talked themselves into something that obviously didn't make sense, because Mike Greenberg, love him for this forever. He made this point on TV, and I don't think he got enough was made out of this. And he was like, you know, every time I have somebody come on here, none of them say that they think that Mac Jones is better than Justin Fields. Not a single one. But everybody was talking themselves into why it was that it would work for him at the number three pick. And I can't figure out if it's because they were defending Mac Jones's whiteness or defending Kyle Shanahan's genius. But it had to be one of the two. It didn't make sense. Nobody else wanted that guy that high. And keep in mind, the 49ers had the 12th pick in the draft. Mac Jones didn't get drafted until 15, which is to say, if they did trade up to take Mac Jones at number three, it would have been extra stupid because they clearly could have gotten the guy just by waiting. And even if he's the guy that you want, at 12, they had a good chance to get Justin Fields. The Bears had to move up to 11 in order to get Justin Fields, right? So that would have made Kyle Shanahan an idiot if he had done this. But nobody was willing to call Kyle Shanahan an idiot. So you know what happened with Mac Jones? Kind of, but not really. Like, Gabe, I guess you don't really follow recruiting like that. Like, I don't follow it like I used to. But people will talk all the time about how a three-star turns into a four-star because he got an offer from Alabama. Because those evaluators trust Nick Saban's eye more than they trust their own. And so they're like, well, if Nick Saban thinks that he's worth it, he must be more than a three-star. And so then everybody went and trusted that next evaluation rather than trusting their own. But with Mac Jones, people didn't even really do that because people still had him as the fifth quarterback in the draft, except for Chris Sims, who for whatever reason is just not here for Justin Fields. But you see what I'm saying? Like, that's what ultimately happened. And so since people didn't have their own convictions and were, I think, in part afraid of like endangering a source, nobody would say if Kyle Shanahan takes Mac Jones at number three, he's a moron. He's not the guy that we thought he was. He's an arrogant dude who thinks that his system matters more than the players that are in it. Nobody wanted to come out there and say it. So what happened instead? Trey Lance was drafted at number three. And my guy, Marcus Thompson, Clark Atlanta University alumnus, wrote a great column about it where he was like, the best part. And look, please understand this. Marcus hit me with a text that day like, is Shanahan really going to take Mac Jones? I got so many texts from people like, is he really going to do that? Like, nobody could actually believe it but Chris Sims. Nobody could believe that he would actually do this. And Marcus Collin for The Athletic about it was so good because he was like, what's the best part about this is Shanahan seemed annoyed that we thought that he would be stupid enough to take Mac Jones at number three. He sounded like me when women I'm dating, like, do you really think I would do that? Right? Like, you thought that's what I meant? You think I would really try to hurt your feelings? Like, I'm not that kind of person. That was basically what Kyle Shanahan was. Like, do you think I'm dumb enough to do that? Are you kidding me? And everybody still tried to come back around. Well, I think he had originally decided to take Mac Jones. And then he went back around and changed his mind. No, I think he looked up and saw this Mac Jones train pumping down the tracks and was like, okay, well, I guess we can play around with this. And so all these people swearing up and down, I'm hearing that the 49ers are going to do this. But who'd you hear it from? I'm hearing the 49ers are going to do this. Who did you hear it from? Because it doesn't sound like anybody actually heard it from the 49ers. And so everybody that did that needs to ask themselves how they got played and how they bit into literally the dumbest draft narrative in the history of draft narratives, where not one person thought that Mac Jones was that good, but all these people talked themselves into the idea that he would be the number three pick in the draft, even though nobody thought he was good enough to do it. That tells you everything about how stupid our draft coverage is. All of it is. Not, and when I say our, I don't mean ESPN. I mean the whole industry at large. We will talk ourselves into something that doesn't make sense for myriad reasons that have very little to do with the players themselves. And who wound up being the biggest loser? Mac Jones. That's who took his happy ass up there to the draft. Now the camera's in your face. And where does he get drafted? By the team that don't got no receivers. That's where he wound up going. You got to go put up with Josh McDaniels every day now, throwing to bums if you get the chance to get out here and actually throw to the bums. Like, he was just in there like, well, y'all, why am I still here? You know what I'm saying? Because I'm sure he had talked himself up. When the other team traded up for Justin Fields, like when the Bears traded up, he was like, yo, I'm good. They like me. They got Andy Dalton. Nah, that's not what happened at all, buddy. That's not it. So, like, maybe good for you. Maybe you want to go live in Boston. And Gabe, I don't know if you saw some of the things that people dug up in the Twitter time machine on Mac Jones, but something tells me that the Mac Jones family probably not so happy with the way that all played out.
Please share, because I didn't see that.
Well, and you know me on this, right? I am not big on the Twitter time machine, especially when it goes back to when people are in high school. I think people have room to grow, so forth and so on. But somebody found a picture of Mac Jones in blackface dressed like Obama with the sign that said "No Obama" in advance of the 2012 election. And I am absolutely willing to give him room to grow, because when you're 12, your parents' politics are your politics. You see what I'm saying? So all I'm saying is, we talked about this all the time, man. I bet his parents in there, like, they just care about them running all the time. Right? Right? Quarterback is a throwing position. It's about your brain. It's about your brain. What kind of brain these boys got? Not boys, you know what I mean. But, you know, it's about your brain. But poor guy slid all the way in that draft. Also, did you see Zach Wilson terrified when the dudes are throwing up signs? So here's the thing about football, man. Football typically gives white dudes some exposure to black life, except he went to BYU and he's from Utah. And so he went to take a picture, and guys, and it didn't even look like they were throwing up sets, right? Like, it just looked like they were doing something with their hands. Everybody likes to throw up a sign, you know what I mean? Like, I got this one right here me and my boys had in college, LRP, long-range pimping. It don't mean nothing, but we just needed something to throw up with our heads, you know what I'm saying? That was what it was. Dude, Zach Wilson was looking at them like, oh my God, what's going on here? What is this? Yeah. Nah. It was a very interesting thing. But again, all I'm saying is, Mac Jones, poor guy. Watch the draft at home. There's no point in going there. You were quickly becoming the plummeting pick. Kyle Shanahan, shout out to you. You were not a dummy. Everybody who thought Kyle Shanahan was a dummy and tried to make him into a genius for doing something that was dumb, you might want to ask yourself, am I a dummy?
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from entertainment.
Hey, my name is Abby Lee Hood. I'm going to be recapping a story I wrote for the Washington Post, specifically The Launcher, which is the video game section of the Post. And I covered the way that fans often rely on video game streamers that they watch play video games live online, for mental health support. Obviously, during the pandemic, people have felt really lonely. They've really craved entertainment, connectedness, and also what we call comfort content, which is content that makes you feel good. So they're watching these streamers every night. They're in these live comment sections, chatting with their favorite streamers and also the other people who are fans as well. And they start to feel really connected. And they may leave a comment like the one that I saw in one of my favorite streamers' comment sections that sort of tipped me off to the story, which was, you gave me a reason to wake up today. And I found that really concerning, because as I learned from talking to Abdallah Nation, who does kid-friendly content on YouTube and does a lot of Nintendo content, streamers are not trained therapists. They're not professionals. So Abdallah trains his moderators, the people who make sure that there's nothing bad or negative happening in the chat. He trains them to signpost fans to therapists, experts, and hotlines. I also chatted with a London-based licensed therapist. Her name is Michelle Ruth. And she basically said that when you rely on streamers, the risk is high because you're letting someone know about your mental health struggles who is not trained to help you. And she did encourage all streamers to behave in similar ways and to train their mods and their admins in the same way that Abdallah does. I also got the chance to talk to Jason Docton of Rise Above the Disorder, or RAD. It started out as a video gaming guild, and then they started a nonprofit that raises money and provides free therapy to people who need it. So the moral of the story is, you can go to your favorite streamer for comfort content, but they're not therapists, and there's no shame in seeking professional help if you need it. We would much rather see you get the help you need than to lose your battle with depression. So please stick around and reach out to the experts who can really help you.
Yeah, so I would say, not only is there no shame in seeking the help of a licensed therapist, I would argue there might be shame in seeking the help of these people that you are seeking your help from. I mean, there's no shame in seeking help. Going to your favorite Twitch streamer, that doesn't seem wise.
I mean, you would imagine that these are safe spaces to the point where you could comfortably share things like that. But it's, to your point, it's not as safe of a space as a therapist would be. And certainly, to Abby's point, are not well equipped to deal with such things.
They're just people. They can give you some advice. They might have some reads on things. But, you know, no.
But people do turn to content creators when they need their spirits to be lifted. Think about during the pandemic over the course of 2020, how many people came our way when they weren't feeling good.
Oh, yeah. I can help you feel better, but we not taking advice questions. We're not giving nobody no guidance. We just giving them something to listen to. That's all I'm saying. Like, nobody's going to have to tell them, guys, you know, though, Bomani's not a licensed therapist. We wasn't doing that.
Heed the advice of the professionals. All right, this next story comes from business.
My name is Brody Ford. I wrote this article for Bloomberg about a group of DoorDash drivers who are trying to influence the algorithm to increase their pay. So right now, DoorDash pays drivers as little as $3 per delivery. This group said, you know, if we all agree to say no to these lowest paying deliveries, the algorithm will have to adjust it. The automatic matching system will understand that people are not accepting these low pay rates, and it will increase rates for everybody. So this group of drivers preaches that they should only accept deliveries that pay $7 or more. And they organize through a Facebook group called Decline Now, and they have over 30,000 members. And they say they've already increased base pay for workers all across the country. But some people are skeptical about whether you can use a company's own system against it for any sustained period. I mean, these algorithms are notoriously opaque, hard to understand, and constantly evolving. Another barrier to their long-term success may be the constant influx of new DoorDash workers, because the company can easily recruit a ton of new drivers by offering sign-on bonuses, and then these new drivers wouldn't know about the $7 rule, right? They wouldn't be part of the club. They would kind of function as strike breakers. And this is really part of a long trend of gig economy workers. Think about people who work for Uber, Lyft, Grubhub, telling us that they're really not getting paid enough. Their work is not reliable. But when your boss is an app, you can't exactly ask for a raise. You can't exactly engage in these traditional workplace negotiations. So this is an example of labor activism for the gig economy.
All right, I want to be clear. They didn't game the algorithm. They basically negotiated with the algorithm. It would be like if you told your boss, okay, we're not going to work those. And then it flipped up. So like, that's my thing. I don't think they gamed it per se. I understand why people are saying that, because it kind of makes them seem cooler, like they got over on the algorithm. And yes, the algorithm will adjust and the algorithm will change, at which point they'll come up with something else. Because while they are correct that there will be this influx of new drivers and the new drivers have a chance of messing up what the game was, well, all these people who are, as I'm saying, negotiating with the algorithm now, they were new drivers once, and then they realized that this was some bullshit. And so at some point, these new ones are going to remember this, realize the same exact thing. And then they're going to have some level of organization. But what you're going to have from now on is a constant back and forth between the drivers and the company and trying to figure out what this is. But they've been doing this in different ways for a long, long time. Like, I talked to somebody once. They went to a football game at MetLife, you know, New Giants Stadium. And those guys are all trying to just get the longest haul possible. And so they'll agree to take you. But if they look up and realize that you ain't hitting them for a big score, they'll decline you. They'll act like they couldn't find you or whatever it was, but they'll cancel you waiting for a long haul, like somebody that could get them 100 something bucks. Because the thing is, you really only get one ride out of the stadium. Like, if you playing the Uber game at the stadium, you're not doing a lot of go there, go back, go there, go back, go there, go back. They trying to hit for the biggest lick. There's been all kinds of little things that have happened like that.
That happens still before with taxis, right? Where you would call a taxi, you tell them where you're going, and the guy's like, eh, nah.
Yeah, but the difference was the taxi didn't tell you it was cool and then tell you that it wasn't.
All right, this last one comes from business.
Hey, this is Whitney Kimball. I'm a reporter for Gizmodo. This week, Amazon announced that it's opening a massive hair salon in London in a district that is already full of barbershops. And it's kind of diabolically genius, because the concept is to bring the Amazon.com shopping experience to you while you're getting your haircut. So you're given a wall of products, which you can scan with a QR code that takes you to the Amazon product listing. For example, you can scan dry shampoo, and it takes you to the website so that you can order it delivered overnight. They're also giving you augmented reality filters so that you can see what you'd look like with different hair colors. And a sort of creepy add-on is that you can point to a product and you'll see information about it pop up on a TV screen. That last feature seems a little dystopian to me, because now they're starting to test out palm readers at Whole Foods in Seattle so that you can attach your palm print to your credit card information and just scan your hand to pay for your groceries. What's interesting about the London location is that London seems to be kind of a test ground for Amazon right now. Last year, it bought a chunk of the UK version of DoorDash, which is called Deliveroo, and it already opened at least 3 cashless grocery stores there and plans to expand to 30 in the UK. Obviously, this raises a lot of questions about Amazon's monopoly. It's currently under investigation by the European Union for allegedly ripping off third-party sellers' data so that it can make its own copycat products for its online marketplace. And this is after the EU filed antitrust charges last year for the same thing. Earlier this year, the UK also said that it plans to investigate Amazon for shutting out competing businesses. And they would probably have a pretty good case. We know that Amazon is getting into all kinds of businesses. It has its own package delivery service, an online pharmacy. It already owns Whole Foods. It's opening other grocery stores. It's been trying to compete with food delivery services, you name it. So when Amazon told us for this story that they don't plan to open any more hair salons, I don't think we have any good reason to believe them.
All right, I mean, I don't need to tell you very much that wasn't already said in there. Like, if that didn't scare you just hearing some of those things, then I'm not going to be the one that's able to help you. I do just want to make this point that I'm Black, right? As a result, you talking about, like, you gonna have Amazon hair salon. Baby, the barbershop been Amazon for a long time. You've been able to cop all kinds of things or whatever you needed at the barbershop for decades in our world without all this creepy stuff that they over here talking about doing. Like, as all, you always been able to buy a pair of socks at a barbershop, for example, right? Like, maybe not 24 hours a day, right? Like, maybe not all the time, but you always been able to do that at the barbershop, you know, round my way. Now Amazon trying to put the DVD man out of business, except is Amazon gonna open up the Black Amazon hair salons or whatever? Like, is there gonna be an Amazon shop? That's what I wanna know about. Let me tell you what you ain't gonna have a whole lot of. People out here paying with their palms. I'm here to tell you that nah, that ain't, Conspiracy Brother is not going for that one at all. Like, I think, you know, when they get out here convincing people to not take the vaccine, that gets a little bit wonky. You out here talking about, man, you really gonna give them your paw print? You get a much more, like, it might turn into a barbershop argument about the vaccine. On this paw print, it might turn into, yeah, man, I think you're right. Good point. Except you ain't gonna need nobody to be like, I think you're right. Man, you better not give them white folks your paw print.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
The Repo Man stories. This one has been coming up for a while in a number of different forms in topics that we've already had. Was there any sort of impetus that you've had in wanting to call for this topic in the past?
Because things about the Repo Man are funny. Like, Gabe be trying to get you all these deep backstories, all this stuff. And it's like, dude, just listen to the words Repo Man. I did have a professor, though, who tells an amazing story about he used to ride around with the Repo Man when he was in high school as a job. And he thought about how funny it was that people would get their stuff taken. And then one day they went to pull up on somebody. He said the dude pulled his tool out the window. He said the Repo Man pulled his tool. And he realized everybody had a tool but him. And that was the last day he rode with the Repo Man. And that's what he gets. Like, what's the joy in that?
Sometimes it just needs to be set up. This first one comes from Mars in Missouri City.
My story with the Repo Man starts when I had to leave Howard University after the pandemic. So Howard sent us home, and originally they said we was only going to be home for 3 weeks, and then we was home for the whole semester. And so then they said we had to move all our stuff out the dorm. But we wasn't there. I'm on the way in Houston, Howard in D.C., right? So we have to call somebody to come move all the stuff out of the dorm. And to this day, I'm not at all sure where my stuff is at, because Howard was like, if you don't get this stuff out of your dorms, we're going to throw it all away. And so I'm just thinking about all the people from around the country, around the world that go to Howard, who just had to put their stuff randomly in storage. And it's now either been repossessed by Howard or by the storage units they put it in, because we ain't been back to school yet.
Not really about the Repo Man, just about having your stuff stolen, more or less. But I do kind of feel bad for you under those circumstances that there wound up happening. Now, though, I'm here to tell you, son, they ain't throwing all your stuff away. The good stuff is being kept. Please believe that.
Kept for what purpose? Like, what is Howard as the hypothetical Repo Man? What are they going to do with that stuff?
Gabe, if my job is to work at a place and throw stuff out, I mean, I can take it to the dumpster. It doesn't have to go in it. Howard's not stealing your TV. But trust me, that's a great day for the people who work with their hands at Howard. It was an incredible come up on a number of levels.
So instead of repossessing from you to the feds, it's repossessing from you to me.
It's redistributed, perhaps more accurately.
This next one comes from Anthony in California.
My girl is one of seven kids from wildly irresponsible parents. The other day we were driving past an apartment complex that she pointed out and said, I used to live there until my parents broke the lease and we left. And I said, why? And then she said one day they were out of the spot and her parents had financed a whole bunch of furniture in one of the children's names and had stopped paying the bill. So the landlord had let the repo man in and these people came back to an apartment that had no furniture at all. So instead of thinking, oh, we did the irresponsible thing, these people went out and got some more furniture on a different kid's name. And they were so embarrassed that their neighbors saw their furniture getting moved out that they packed up this furniture from Washington and drove clear to Florida. Yep.
So when the man talked about his girl's wildly irresponsible parents, we all made faces as we're like, oh, my God, why are you saying that? And then by the end, we're like, yeah, dog, your girl's parents are wildly irresponsible. I hope she knows they're wildly irresponsible, by the way. Like, that would be my thought if I were you. Like, she knows that's not how you're supposed to live, right? They move all the way from the northwestest of the lower 48 to the southeastest of the lower 48 out of shame. But you're not too shame to get furniture in your kids' names.
You're signing your kid up to have poor credit.
Yeah, that part. It's just, by the way, that dude right there tells that story all the time.
All right, this next one comes from Jesus in Chicago.
So back in 2002, before I left for the military, I was working as a cable guy for Comcast. And this particular day, I was given a stack of jobs to do, and it was nothing but disco. And if you don't know what that means I was tasked with coming to your crib and cutting off your And some of them were planned. Most of them were delinquent accounts, though. On this day, I rolled up to this tough-ass hood in North Chicago. And I'm not talking about the north side of Chicago. I'm talking about North Chicago. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up. Anyway, I have no idea what it looks like now, but back then it was pretty gully. Anyway, I pulled up to this customer who was delinquent. And as soon as I jump out the van, there was this dude on the porch. It looked like he was sitting there just waiting on me. And this dude looked like he was straight out of county. He was sitting there all swolled up, had this tank top on. As soon as I jumped out the van, he got up. And he's like, you know, if you go up that pole, we're going to have a problem. And I guess because he saw me with my tools, he decided it was a good time to go and get his. So as soon as he turned around to go into the house, dude, I just did a 180. I went right back into that van. I wrote no access on that work order. I was gone, dude. I wasn't going to take any chances that day. Anyway, I guess I was the repo man that day, but that was a pretty funny experience now looking back on it.
Yo, so this is an important distinction between the cable man disconnected and the repo man, because the repo man is getting paid by the car, not by the hour. There is absolutely no incentive for this dude to go up that pole. The repo man, under the same circumstance, he got the gun out already, right? Like, there is no, I'm going to go to my house and get my gun with the repo man, because the repo man is already out here like, hey, pulling that shirt up. Don't even. Hey, I already thought about that, baby. I already thought about that. Cable man, the cable man's not getting the tool to go around and do the work. But there's nothing like when somebody tells you, nah, you ain't about to do this. Like my homeboy, God rest his soul, man. Freshman year of college, we had homecoming coordination. He had done it up big, man. Like he had him a date, got a rental car, like whole nine, you know? And it turned out to be one of Murphy's Law nights. But one of the things that happened in the night was he locked his keys in the car. And again, this is 1997. So like the cars are not equipped for you to, you know, like have the joint that you can get or whatever. And you got to call somebody to come unlock your car, but you don't have a cell phone. And so I don't remember how he came up with it, but he called the tow truck. The tow truck could always come pop your lock for you. So he called the tow truck and the tow truck got there and he popped the lock for him. He was like, great. And dude was like, how much does it cost? He says, $75 in 1997 money. He says, $75. My man's like, I don't have $75. And he said the tow man tried to lock the door and shut it again. My man said he threw himself into the door. Like, I don't know what this going to be, but you not locking this back up. That's the only part I know. Whew. God, that was fun. I mean, these stories, not that. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing 3 times a week. Gabe Bassett and Tony Colletti, you would handle things behind the scenes. Thank you, guys. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Abby Lee Hood. Check out their story at The Washington Post on content creators providing support to their followers. Thanks to Brody Ford of Bloomberg. Check out his story on how DoorDash drivers are getting around the algorithm to get more money. And thanks to Whitney Kimball of Gizmodo. Check out her story about Amazon opening a hair salon. Right. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.